Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Swirling out in the Atlantic is Hurricane Erin, the first major hurricane of the 2025 season, and it is a monster. On Friday, it strengthened to a Category 5 storm with winds of 160 miles per hour spanning out over 650 miles in diameter. It's not going to hit our coast, but there will be 25-foot waves, we are told, around some of the beaches. Fortunately, Erin is predicted to stay well out to sea. Hurricanes form in the Atlantic in the summer due to warming temperatures. As the air warms, so does the water. And in recent years, the ocean has been warming at an alarming rate, one of the clearest indicators of climate change. Last year was the warmest on record for the oceans. And that means the reshaping of ecosystems, weather patterns, and eventually, the economy. It also means changes in migratory and feeding patterns for creatures that live in the sea, including sharks. These animals have gotten a bad reputation, thanks in part to the success of the Jaws films. They are not the bloodthirsty creatures they've been portrayed to be, but they are at the top of a food chain, and their health can indicate the well-being of the larger ecosystem. So what is the impact of warmer waters on the shark population? Are they coming closer to shore in larger numbers looking for food and endangering beachgoers in the process? And what about our fishing practices? What impact is that having on their numbers? We look at all that this hour, including whether the shark meat you might buy at the seafood counter is actually what the label says it is. To help us learn about all this, we're joined by UNC Chapel Hill Grand Slam. Dr. John Bruno is with us. He is a marine ecologist and professor in the Department of Biology at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Savannah Ryburn is a marine ecologist who earned her PhD at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, as a member of Dr. Bruno's lab. And Dr. Joel Fraddy is Professor and the director of the Institute of Marine Sciences at UNC Chapel Hill's, I guess, the extension in Morehead City is the best way to say that. Thank you all for being here. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
So, Joel, let me start by putting this Jaws stuff into perspective. There is no question that these movies increased people's fears of being attacked and bitten and possibly killed by sharks in the ocean. But just how valid are these fears?
Yeah, so Jaws is a great movie. One of my favorites. The reality is that in North Carolina, we spend millions of hours in the water every year as a group. People don't know this, but North Carolina has the fourth most beach visits of any state in the country year after year. People think of Florida, California, Hawaii. Well, we're next on the list. And we average in this state 1 to 2 attacks a year. And that's just an incredibly low number. Yes, there are sharks out there. That's where sharks live. Anytime you've been in the water, if you taste any salt in the water, there's probably a shark somewhere within a few football fields of you. And I suppose that can make some people feel maybe a little less comfortable. But the reality is that's also proof that sharks have really no interest in people. And they do most all they can to just avoid people. They're really skittish animals.
Yeah, I read yesterday that in the last 90 years that we've been keeping track of this, there have been around 80 shark attacks. That's an incredibly small number in 90 years, it seems to me. John, you've studied the effect of warming oceans on shark behavior. Have the chances of swimmers coming into contact near the beach increased, decreased, stayed the same in that time?
That's a really good question. Honestly, Dr. Fodry is probably a better expert at that specific area.
Doctor?
Yeah, I mean, if anything, we went through a phase where we probably killed off a lot of sharks. But I think the long-term trend and maybe one more attack a year, that's more about how many people are in the water. There are certainly more people in the water now than ever before. And so I suspect the per capita odds, they just remain astronomically low. They always have been and continue to be very low.
You said that we, and I've watched these films on television of people like you, marine biologists, going in the water and getting right up close, even touching sharks that most people would be scared to death of, and they don't seem to be interested in us at all, but they do occasionally bite people and sometimes kill people. So are there things that we are doing that attract them, and are there things that we can do to not attract them if we're going to go into the surf? I'm not sure which one of you to ask that question of.
Yeah, well, there's... go ahead, Savannah.
All three of you.
I was just going to say, I mean, I wouldn't say we're attracting them in any way, but I wouldn't, of course, swim during dawn or dusk when their feeding times are most popular. And then also swimming towards like murky water where they can't see as well. That's where you're most likely going to have an encounter of some sort.
But are there things that we do physically, or are they curious about us? Do they just bump into us and think, let's see what that is? And that's when they bite. They're just curious, and then they either let go or they don't. I mean, how does that work?
John? They are definitely really curious about us. So like anytime we're doing scientific research, if there's sharks nearby, they almost immediately come over to check out what you're doing. And that's particularly true if you have any kind of electronic instrument. So they have sensors that enables them to sense prey. And so anytime we have something electronic underwater, that can attract them. But yeah, they're really curious. They're really intelligent. They can be territorial. So in some of the reefs we work on, they'll come over and kind of make like aggressive displays, kind of warning us off. But then they usually lose interest within a minute or two and go off and kind of do their thing.
Because I read yesterday that James Bell, who's the North Carolina Aquarium Shark Advocacy Consultant, said that, quote, human biochemistry and biorhythms are like an irritating sandpaper alarm clock to sharks. They don't like our heartbeats, and they don't like the way we swim. It's weird to them. I know, Joel, that you say sharks are risk averse, but do you agree with what he just said?
Well, layering on what John said, you know, those tropical systems with the clear water, I can think of sharks, you know, they get curious. In our more murky water, anytime I get near a shark, it's kind of like a surprise, and they just spook really easily.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's a water clarity, you know, thing. So, you know, there are different types of sharks. We've got 20 to 25, 30 species you could see here. Bull sharks are probably less skittish than a dusky or a silky. So there's a range, but in generally a lot of their behaviors, even their physical adaptations, like these eye covers they have, you know, sharks are trying to find food. They're trying to find a mate. And they're also, I think a lot of times trying to avoid risk. Those are the three things that kind of drive them. And so a lot of what we do, just being the size that we are for most sharks, that's not an appealing combination of things they're drawn to.
But I've read several times yesterday, and you've said that they like to avoid risk. They are risk averse, but they are an apex predator. Who's coming after the sharks that they need to feel skittish about being careful?
Mostly other sharks. Yeah. A couple of them, when they're full grown, are apex predators, tiger sharks, great white sharks. But, you know, before they get to that stage, they're prey of their own species. So, yeah, they're pretty skittish. And now, of course, they've got orcas to worry about. So recently, orcas started attacking even the biggest, most scary sharks in the ocean, great whites. So, yeah, they're prey, too. So they're always like looking behind their shoulder.
And if that's
not all shark species are apex predators. A lot of them are considered mesopredators, which are the step below. And they also vary a lot in size depending on the species. So like the bonnethead shark, which is really common off the coast of North Carolina, really is only like 4 to 5 feet long max. So when you're putting something like that up next to like a huge like bull shark or something like that, it's definitely going to be terrified.
John, you just said that now that orcas are coming after them, they have to worry about that. Is that a recent phenomenon? And if so, why?
Yeah, it appears to be a recent phenomenon. I mean, it's mostly based on media reports that we've all been seeing. And it's become really common. I have no idea why. I don't think anybody does. It's really bizarre. It almost seems a little vindictive. I believe they're attacking them and eating the liver, that just like, you know, disposing of the rest of the body. I mean, orcas are doing some other weird behaviors too, so it's not really clear what's going on there.
Well, Savannah, you study what sharks eat. How about who eats sharks? Let's talk about that for a second, because if suddenly orcas are going after sharks and eating their liver and leaving the rest behind, does that say something about the ecosystem?
I mean, I wouldn't, with the orcas, basically it could be with climate change and changing of where the prey goes and trying to find where specific they can get like their meal. They can alter their diet depending on what's available to them.
Let's talk about shark diets, because you, Savannah, study shark diets. That's one of the things that you do. And because of Jaws, once again, we think of ourselves as part of the shark diet, or potentially. I'm not sure that that is true. But when they're looking for food, are they thinking of us, or do we just get in the way?
They're definitely not thinking of us when they're searching for food. I think it would just be a fluke encounter if you were to be targeted in any way by a shark, and just like pure curiosity. When it comes to the sharks off of North Carolina, they mainly eat, or like the four species that I studied, which was the bonnethead, the Atlantic sharp nose, the black tip, and the black nose, which are all very common. They mainly eat small fish and crustaceans. The bonnethead shark mainly eats blue crabs, which is surprising for a lot of people because they think of sharks eating like their big fish that they're trying to catch and everything. But some of them only eat like crabs.
Yeah. Prior to Jaws.
Now, if I could jump in real quick. So bonnetheads may be one of the species that is becoming more abundant in North Carolina, in part because of warming waters. We don't have great hard data, but a lot of anecdotal, everybody you talk to would say, gosh, I just don't remember seeing that many bonnetheads. And now they're really abundant. And as Savannah said, they're really blue crab eating factories. And someone I trust, I've not fact checked this, but someone I trust told me that the bonnethead has the softest bite in the shark universe. And in fact, when you look in their stomachs, the blue crabs that are in their stomachs, they're completely whole. It's like the bonnethead just sort of lovingly slurped, almost like a kitchen mitten, slurped the crab, grabbed the crabs and slurped them up. So blue crab is our state's most important commercial fishery by weight and value. And so now you've got this predator that's eating something that we also see value in economically, just sort of highlighting how sharks play a really important ecosystem role and things do change.
So you talked about finding out what's in their stomachs. And I suppose that's one way to figure out, other than observing them eating, that's one way to find out what sharks are dining on these days. But that's a fatal way. There's no way back from that, because you're opening the shark up and looking at their stomachs. Savannah, you take a different approach, and we only have 30 seconds left in the segment, so I'm not going to ask you a question about it yet. But when we come back, I want to talk about the way you study a shark diet, because to some people, including myself, it may sound relatively disgusting. But we'll talk about that when you come back. We're talking about sharks, their impact on the ecosystem, the ecosystem's impact on them because of climate change, and how they interact or don't interact with us, and in many different ways, including at the grocery store counter. We'll talk about that when we come back. We're talking to Dr. Joel Fodry, professor and director of the Institute of Marine Science at UNC Chapel Hill in Morehead City, Dr. Savannah Ryburn, a marine ecologist, and Dr. John Bruno, a marine ecologist at UNC Chapel Hill. It's Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sharks, their impact on the ecosystem, and the climate change's impact on them and other marine life with three marine ecologists, a UNC Chapel Hill trifecta, Dr. John Bruno, a marine ecologist and professor of this at UNC Chapel Hill, Dr. Savannah Ryburn, also a marine ecologist, and Dr. Joel Fodry, professor and director of the Institute of Marine Science at UNC Chapel Hill's arm in Morehead City. So, Savannah, you study what sharks eat, what is in their diet, and you do it by examining fecal matter. And I'm interested in how you collect that material.
Yeah, so like you previously said, traditionally, the diets of many marine animals was studied just using their stomach contents. So that's usually lethal. But I've started using a newer method where I actually take a swab, similar to like what you would see doing a COVID test, and you insert the swab into the shark's cloaca for 10 seconds, just get a swab of their fecal matter. And from there, the shark can be released immediately back into the water. So in total, it's usually about a 2-minute workup, and then the shark's back in the water swimming free. And then from there, with that swab of the fecal matter, I do DNA analysis on that to figure out, to the species level, what that shark had ingested.
And what have you discovered about their dietary habits?
Yeah, so I've done this on 4 different species off the coast of North Carolina, and then also on 2 juvenile shark species in the Galapagos. And something interesting that I found in the Galapagos is juvenile blacktip sharks are mainly eating an endemic species of mullet, which means that it's only found in the Galapagos archipelago. And this is also one of the primary target species for the local fishermen in the Galapagos as well. So these juvenile sharks, we think they're using these nursery habitats for the first few years of their lives, which are these small sheltered mangrove bays, and most likely for protection from other predators, like we were talking, like other shark species. Even sea lions are eating the juveniles. And they're also using it as a potential source of food. So it's very interesting how we're going to need to navigate protecting their primary prey species, which are also a main source of income and food for the local community.
Are you discovering anything that we didn't know about shark diets through the other method, which is generally fatal, where we have to open their stomachs up and see what they've eaten? Are you discovering anything different or surprising that we didn't know?
Yeah, so with the stomach contents method, that actually is way more gross and disgusting than doing the swab, because you actually have to like open the stomach, sort through everything manually. It smells awful. Whereas the swab is just like, it just looks like brown, like, yeah, just brown on a swab. It doesn't even smell really. So with that, the stomach method, it's pretty vague most of the time. So you take it, you're looking under a microscope, trying to identify to the lowest possible level what that shark had eaten. And a lot of the time it's very digested, and or you get like a fin of a fish, and or like a small piece of the crab's shell. So you're not able to actually identify the prey to the species level mainly. A lot of the time it's that these sharks are eating bony fish. So it's not very detailed. Whereas the DNA method with the swab, I can get down mostly to the genus and species level of the prey, which is very helpful when you're trying to figure out like specifics with policy and things like that.
Dr. Bruno, you have said, I read that you said it's problematic when top predators are starving because of what that indicates about other fish in the sea. So are sharks and other fish at the top of the food chain starving? Are they suffering because of climate change?
Generally, yes. One of the big impacts of climate change on predators is the decline, pretty widespread decline across the entire ocean in productivity. And there's a couple of reasons that's happening. There's essentially less nutrients getting up to the ocean surface from the deep sea, things like nitrogen and phosphorus that phytoplankton need to photosynthesize. So we have less and less plant material, less plant productivity, and that, of course, is the basis of the food chain. And we can see that cascade all the way up to the top predators. So top predator population declines that we're actually tracking, that we're measuring, are almost always caused by the disappearance of their prey.
I was going
to
ask
also something with to tie into the sharks with that is the other juvenile species that I study in the Galapagos is the scalloped hammerhead, which is critically endangered and their populations are continuing to decline. But at the juvenile life stage, they have a really high mortality rate. And it's been found, especially in Hawaii, that it's mainly due to starvation.
Before the show started, I think it was you, Dr. Bruno, who asked about whether or not we talk about this a lot on this program. And we do. And we know that the oceans absorb nearly 90% of the added heat that is in our atmosphere. And that causes rising seawater temperatures, rising sea levels, because sea ice is melting, greater ocean acidification. We know what it does to people on the beaches with sunny day flooding, etc. But you study marine ecosystems and the impact of all of this on that. Generally speaking, what has been, what is the impact, aside from what you just talked about, of the warming ocean waters on sea life?
The way we often think about it, even as scientists, as like the warming of the oceans, particularly the short-term heat waves that I study a lot on Caribbean coral reefs, so these pulses of temperatures that are, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 degrees Celsius warmer than usual, just kills off organisms, right? It exceeds their tolerance. And that's like these, you get these big die-offs. You probably have heard of coral bleaching. So that's essentially like a die-off of corals in response to a short-term heat wave. But there's a much more widespread phenomena happening where the oceans are warming nearly as fast as the land. And what that's doing is increasing the metabolism of essentially every organism in the ocean, everything other than marine birds and mammals, because these are all cold-blooded organisms. So their body temperature matches that of the seawater. So when the seawater warms, their body warms, and that speeds up their metabolism. And what that means is they've got to eat more just to stay alive. So their caloric demand is increasing all the time with warming. And then you can see where I'm going with this, right? So the caloric demand is increasing, but prey are not increasing. In fact, many places, prey abundance are declining because of this decrease in ocean, the ocean's productivity that we talked about. So we're seeing more and more of a mismatch between the caloric demands of the consumers, especially the top predators, and the ability of the food web to feed them. And ultimately, that is leading to kind of shrinking populations over time.
And that should concern all of us. Dr. Fondre, you've said that we don't yet understand all of the important roles that sharks play in the ecosystem, but we do know that reduced numbers of sharks can result in a reduction in the number of aquatic animals that are further down the food chain, which seems unintuitive. Explain that.
Yeah, and if I could just go back 1 second to layer on what John said too. I think in North Carolina, the impacts are even, you know, more complex in that we are seeing these rain shifts. So animals are trying to find a certain temperature of water. So now we have animals moving latitudinally or into different depths. And then the jargony word of science is phenology, but it just means the seasonal timing of things. So the seasonal timing and when we're seeing like fishes show up or the bigger fishes like sharks show up, all that's shifting. So what used to happen in May might now happen in late April. And that can decouple or couple new things as different animals are moving around. And this is a very dynamic coast. We do have a warm current like the Gulf Stream and a cooler water influence, Labrador current influence water. This all mixes around Cape Hatteras. So when you go from Wilmington to our south, you know, to Maniope in our north, that's a huge environmental gradient that all of these climate change things are kind of layered on top of, very complex. All right, now the sharks at the top affecting the food web going down, There's a working hypothesis supported by some data that in North Carolina, the loss of the big sharks, and Savannah kind of mentioned this, has allowed the rise of these middle-sized sharks, the mesopredators. These are things, and John said this too, things that used to get eaten by the big sharks are now able to go around with impunity, and they're no longer as afraid or chomped as often. Well, these mesopredators, and this includes small sharks and rays, all the things that they eat, shellfish, smaller fish, well, now they're getting chomped harder because the things in the middle aren't being mowed down by the things at the top. There's a really nice series of papers that show in more tropical systems. We like sharks, as scientists, we like turtles. You need both to have healthy seagrass systems. Seagrasses are grasses that grow underwater. Well, if you lose the sharks but keep the turtles, we like turtles, but the turtles are lawnmowers and they will just mow the grass down. And the grass is really important as habitat for shrimps and crabs and fishes. It captures carbon, it stabilizes sediments. So we can't just save the turtles because they're cute and, you know, we love turtles. We have to save the sharks to maintain some balance. So those sorts of top-down roles are really important.
So this change in the ecosystem, the warming of the water, which is changing which fish are where, when, has ramifications, I would guess, Dr. Bruno, for us. Some say that feeding patterns of fish are changing, and you've just alluded to that, and meaning that some sharks are moving closer to the coast, which maybe gives them greater exposure to us or us to them. Others say that sharks are actually, and I think Dr. Fadri just said this, are diving into deeper waters to find cooler water, to find prey. Are both things happening simultaneously?
Yeah, definitely. That's the fun of all this. All these things are happening simultaneously. You know, I was talking about the increase in caloric demand, and Joel talked about what scientists call trophic cascades, and like this warming is actually accelerating and strengthening these trophic cascades, right? So like all these things are changing. Yeah, sharks are shifting their behavior, the depths that they swim in part to avoid the warming. One of the challenges, though, normally you'd think they would just go deeper to avoid the warm temperatures at the surface, but a lot of the deeper ocean waters are suffering from this thing that we call deoxygenation. So the concentration of oxygen, especially in deeper waters, is declining. Sharks breathe just like people, but they breathe underwater. They extract oxygen from seawater, and the less oxygen there is, that becomes a really big problem for them. So they're kind of getting sandwiched into this narrower layer. They're avoiding the surface because it's too warm. Then they have to start avoiding the deeper water because there's less oxygen.
Wow. How quickly can they react to these things?
They can certainly sense the temperature. So they'll like move around and avoid warm water. I'm not sure that they can sense the oxygen concentration. So I'm not sure about that kind of the rate of response to that. They're also shifting the ranges. Pretty much every organism in the ocean, the plankton, the fishes, the mammals, the sharks, they're all shifting their geographic range. And generally, they're all moving polewards. They're all moving away from the equator, trying to stay in the same kind of what we call thermal niche, the same body of water. And that's why off the coast of North Carolina, we're seeing all kinds of tropical species really take a foothold and expand. I mean, we've got armadillos in, 20 counties in North Carolina now. We'll have them in every county in the next decade or two. So we're seeing this phenomena both on the land and in the ocean. All the world species are moving away from the equator. So they're shifting where they live. And that's completely kind of jumbling up what we call species composition, who lives with who. And like Joel was mentioning, there's all kinds of new predators arriving in North Carolina. There's new prey, there's new diseases, there's new parasites. So the whole system is kind of getting like shaken up in a bottle and then kind of let go.
Which leads us, Dr. Ryburn, to tracking. It's easier to track animals and their migratory patterns and their feeding habits on land because we share the land with them. We don't share the oceans with the fish unless we're people like you who go into the ocean frequently to study them. How do we track them? I know that when you test them or test their diets through the method we just talked about, one of the things that you do is tag them. Then who follows that tag? How do we track them?
Yeah, so there's many different ways to tag an animal. One of the easiest is putting what's called a pit tag in the animal when you capture it and do the quick workup. And you can think of something like this as like doing a microchip for your pet. And this basically is like an ID tag with a specific number. And that when you release the shark, if you happen to re-catch that animal, you can scan it like they do at the vet and see if there is an associated ID number. And then from there, you can see how it's grown since the last time you've captured it and any other changes that have occurred to the animal. And that's like the easiest way. But you can also do a satellite tag, which is basically a tag that is attached to the dorsal fin, so that top fin on the shark. And when the animal breaches the surface, it will connect to a satellite up in space and basically give you the horizontal movements of that animal, so like where it's traveled. One issue with that, though, is that the animal's fin does have to breach the surface. So if it's a deep diving shark that doesn't normally go to the surface very often, you're going to have a hard time actually getting data from that. But there's also other types of tags that do vertical movement. So how deep the animal is diving and things like that, and like where within the ocean's depth they're spending their time. But those tags, you also have to retrieve the actual tag to get the information, which can be a challenge.
Yeah, it can't be easy. But are we learning things that we didn't know before? And are we learning things about how climate change is affecting these animals through this method?
Yeah, so another way to also track the sharks is using an acoustic tag, which basically sends out a sound wave underwater every second. And you can track it actively using a hydrophone underwater. And with that, you actually have to be present and following the shark to acquire the location data. And I actually did this for a few of the juvenile scalloped hammerhead sharks in the Galapagos. There was no previous knowledge about what this shark species, like where this shark species was moving in the Galapagos as juveniles. So there's a large knowledge gap on shark movements, depending on the species and where in the world they're located. But definitely more information is needed to know where they're moving, because I only found I found varied results.
Dr. Savannah Ryburn, a marine ecologist, we're talking about sharks. We will continue in just a moment and look into other aspects of what's going on out there in the oceans. It's Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte, aiming to inspire high school students through an international curriculum and IB diploma program, preparing them for college, careers, and a global community. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about sharks today and climate change and other aspects of the changing ecology of the oceans because of climate change with three marine ecologists, Dr. John Bruno from UNC Chapel Hill, Dr. Savannah Ryburn, also from UNC. Well, they're all from UNC Chapel Hill. And Dr. Joel Fodry, a professor and director of the Institute of Marine Sciences in Morehead City. We were talking about tracking sharks a moment ago. And Joel, in June, one of the largest great white sharks that researchers have ever recorded in the Northwest Atlantic was just off of Cape Hatteras. This is back in June, a 14-foot great white named Contender. It has a name, which tells me that it has been tagged and it is being tracked. We've met him before. How do you tag a great white?
Very carefully. This is work done by a group called OSearch, where they, I think they hook and line the sharks, I believe, but they basically get the shark on a deck that can kind of float in very shallow, a foot or so to the water. And as Savannah said, I think they drill holes through the dorsal, they attach this tag to the dorsal, and great whites are one of these species that surfaces, spends a lot of time at the surface. So it can transmit periodically. This great white research in North Carolina goes back to the like 19 teens. There was a guy named Russell Coles, a buddy of Theodore Roosevelt, who would come to the Cape Lookout region to catch sharks. This was a day of just thinking about like their very gross biology, how big they get, where are their fins at. They weren't to the stage of doing ecology, but we're now a century into people studying great whites off of our coast because they do visit. They are certainly not the typical shark of North Carolina. The typical shark is, I think Savannah said, 3 to 4 foot long. But yeah, we get visited by sharks like great whites and tigers and bulls and great hammerheads. And these are called the great sharks by some people.
Yeah, the great white, for people who don't know, is the shark in Jaws. That's the shark that we think about when we think about Jaws. But there are over 500, I'm told, Dr. Bruno, there are over 540 different species of sharks in the ocean, maybe more. In fact, we just haven't found them all yet. How many off our coast? How many different species off our coast?
I don't know the answer to that, but I bet Dr. Faudry does.
Yeah, they report that over 50 have been caught in our waters, depending on how you define our waters. But I would say that 20 to 25, you shouldn't be at all surprised to see in North Carolina.
And did they each have a specific job or a specific thing that they accomplish in the ecosystem?
Well, I like Savannah did a good job of highlighting this with her work, but for a lot of people, and even when I'm out in the water, you know, sharks are gray on the top, they're white on the bottom, and they've got black fin tips. And in fact, the best way to identify a black tip shark is by the absence of a black anal fin tip. So they're really hard to tell apart. That's the point. Hmm. But yet, as Savannah's work shows, other people's work is highlighting now, you know, they have very different diets. They're very different sizes. Small sharks can be a couple feet. The big sharks are 15 feet. These are not functionally the same animals. They have diverse roles, but we're only kind of at the tip of the iceberg, I think, of fully understanding how they all contribute in their unique ways to our system.
Savannah, last month, the Miami Herald ran an article about how the warming ocean is impacting Florida's shark population. They reported that if the ocean surface temperature warms by 2.01 degrees Celsius, that could alter migratory patterns for sharks, and that could become a reality within 25 years. So I had to look it up because 2 degrees doesn't sound like much, but 2 degrees Celsius is about 35.6 degrees Fahrenheit. That makes a difference. Do we really anticipate? Because the ocean temperature I saw yesterday when they were forecasting the track of the hurricane in some parts of the ocean was 85 to 95 degrees. A 35-degree temperature increase would put it in triple digits. Do we really anticipate that happening in the next 25 years?
Yeah, I mean, as carbon emissions and everything with pollution and being stagnant with policy at the moment, yeah, I definitely foresee things like that happening. But I also think John can expand on that question a lot more.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry, but your conversion's off a little bit. So like 2 degrees Celsius is about, in terms of warming, is about 5 degrees Fahrenheit in warming.
Well, then it's not my conversion, it's Google's. So
yeah, okay, Google. Yeah, ChatGPT or whoever. But that's an enormous amount of warming. Like, you know, you just putting your foot in the ocean, like your body can tell the difference between like 1 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit. So 5 would be huge. So far the ocean's warmed by about 1 degree Celsius, about 2 degrees Fahrenheit. And so we're only talking about another 2 degrees Celsius. So we almost certainly will see that by the end of the century. Wow. We'll see another degree Celsius in the next 3 to 4 decades, given the warming right now.
So the Miami Herald also reports that if temperature rise like that occurs, sharks may not stay long or may not swim as far south as Florida at all, and that would be bad for the Florida ocean ecosystem, and it would also result in more sharks swimming along the North Carolina coast or the North and South Carolina coast. What would that mean, John, in both cases?
I mean, I'd love to see more sharks along the North Carolina coast. But yeah, losing them from those tropical ecosystems is a problem. It's hard to really diagnose how much of a problem because, like I already mentioned, everything else is leaving too. So a lot of their prey are leaving. A lot of the corals are dying, the species that create the habitat, the seagrass. So yeah, the tropics, especially down near the equator where it's warmest, is where we mostly are seeing the biggest impacts of climate change. That said, the poles are also warming incredibly rapidly. There's places off of Gulf of Maine that have already warmed like 9 to 10 degrees Fahrenheit. So we have these like regional hotspots where warming is just incredibly fast.
And not all sharks dislike warmer waters. Bull sharks seem to thrive in it. Bull sharks can survive, I'm told, both in salt and fresh water, if that's not mistaken. At least in the Gulf of Mexico, they are increasing in number and getting hungrier. So what does that tell you?
I mean, I think, like I mentioned before, they're getting hungrier because their metabolism is increasing, because the water is increasing, so they've got to eat more. So that explains that. There are certainly lots of sharks that love tropical water. You know, the equatorial water should be full of sharks. They largely are gone because of fishing. So it's like incredibly rare to see a shark on a Caribbean coral reef anymore. That's not due to warming, that's due to fishing. But loving warm water, being adapted to current warm conditions, doesn't mean you're going to be able to survive another like 5 degrees Fahrenheit of warming. So we will lose sharks and almost all fishes from tropical seas, you know, a century or two from now, if we don't get a handle on greenhouse gas emissions.
It also depends on their prey source too. So like if their prey's not there, they can't live there either. So.
And John highlights a really important point is we're running sort of two grand experiments at the same time. Number one is climate change and the other is the effects of fishing. And, you know, probably in the 90s, Shark Week has become whatever it is. But when it first started, it really changed people's hearts and minds about what sharks were. It sort of coincided with some major conservation efforts that have continued. We're now 3 decades in. And for some species, not all species, but for some species, we're starting to see maybe the beginning of some recovery. Sharks can be fairly long-lived, so this is going to play out over decades, not months. But so trying to untangle the effects of whatever fishing pressure is from the effects of climate change is just going to make the job more interesting, I'll say.
A lot of species of fish have been overfished. We're told we shouldn't order a grouper in a restaurant. We shouldn't order Chilean sea bass because they're overfished and they're in danger. What about sharks? How badly have they been overfished, Joel?
Pretty badly, especially because when you think about their reproductive rates, they reproduce at a relatively low rate. A shark species might pup one or two newborns a year compared to something like blue crabs that can produce 1 million eggs in a year. So they're just sort of, they're teed up to experience overfishing pressure relatively easily. There are some data from the Gulf that suggest that commercial fishery lasted about 10 years from when it ramped up to when it kind of was out of big fish to catch. It only took about 10 years. Now the recovery could take again, decades. So it's a species you've got to manage. There are shark species that you can manage sustainably. We know that spiny dogfish, some of maybe of our small coastal sharks, different groups, outside groups have looked at that and said, okay, we think we can call that sustainable if it's done right. Other species, you probably are best off leaving alone. And these are maybe some of the bigger sharks like silkies and duskies.
Dr. Bruno, do we have sufficient regulations in place and are those regulations enforced?
I think absolutely not. And part of the problem is that sharks are highly migratory. We discovered over the last couple of decades, you know, they can spend some time off Miami, go to North Carolina, then they're in Newfoundland, then they're off of Greece. I mean, they're using the whole ocean as their backyard. So we might have strict rules in the U.S. and they might be well enforced in Canada, but then they swim down to maybe South America where there's essentially no rules. So they're exposed to like the whole world. That's part of the problem. So in most of the world's oceans, sharks are still, it's perfectly allowed to fish them. I work primarily now in the Galapagos Marine Reserve where shark fishing is technically not allowed, but it is still incredibly common. So it's illegal, but it's very difficult to like enforce like bans like that across like the whole ocean basin. So my team works with the park They'll catch a fishing boat that's been illegally harvesting sharks. They'll come into shore. We count the sharks. We identify them. We measure them. And they might have like 500 sharks on the boat that were caught illegally just over the last couple of days. So it's still really intensive out there for sharks.
And Dr. Fadri,
it's also too common to catch them as bycatch as well. So like even if the fishing boats aren't targeting sharks per se, their fishing equipment commonly catches sharks unintentionally, which will result in killing them.
So Dr. Fadri, you and some of your lab students have been studying the shark meat that we find in some grocery stores. This was back in 22 and 23. And you found that within the 30 samples that you collected, 97% were mislabeled. Expand on that. What did you find?
So I appreciate it, but that's certainly in John and Savannah's court. Oh. So I'll bounce it to them.
I'm sorry. I thought that was your question.
It's okay. Yeah, Mike, no worries. That was actually a class that I teach, and Savannah and I actually co-taught that semester. And yeah, the students asked the question. One of the students came up with it. She found shark labeled just as shark in a grocery store in Charlotte and asked, like, what is it? So we purchased it from these 30 vendors, and we sequenced the DNA to identify it to species. And Savannah actually led this project, and she found that only one of the 30 sharks samples was labeled correctly. I mean, mostly they're generically labeled as sharks, so they don't even tell you what species it is. But the really frightening thing is we saw scalloped hammerheads, greater hammerheads, you know, several sharks that are incredibly overfished. And like Joel mentioned, very sensitive to fishing because they live for centuries and they have a really low reproductive output. But from the human perspective, these animals have an incredible concentration of mercury in their tissue because they're so long lived, because they feed high up in the food chain. So that mercury that comes from coal power plants ends up in the bodies of sharks in a really high concentration. So like no human should be eating hammerhead sharks, but like you have no way to avoid it in the grocery store if it's just labeled as shark.
So Savannah, since you studied this, is this mislabeling deliberate or is it merely out of ignorance?
That is a very good question that we have no idea. So the seafood industry, there's so many steps from it being taken out of the ocean and ending up on your plate that there's so many checkpoints where the accidental mislabeling could happen or intentional. Once the animal is like filleted and it becomes just a steak of meat, it's extremely hard to tell just with the eye what the actual species is. So like a spiny dogfish, which is tiny and like sustainably harvested, could look exactly like a great hammerhead steak in the grocery store.
Everything that we have talked about this hour, everything that we know about sharks, about the ocean, about climate, about the climate's impact on the ocean and that of other aquatic sea life, comes from research, the kind of work that the three of you do. But recently, the federal government, John, has cut back severely on funding for these projects and other projects that have nothing to do with your work. How have these cuts affected you and your work?
They've affected my lab specifically, but honestly, all my colleagues across the U.S. massively. So we all rely on the National Science Foundation primarily, but also other federal and state agencies for our funding. UNC does not give us money for funding. So, you know, we're 9-month employees. So when we do research, we obtain it from other agencies and go out during the summertime and do the research. So it's massively cut off funding. And it's not even clear yet how much. So NSF announced a few months ago they were going to eliminate a large majority of their programs, like specific programs fund, you know, specific kinds of research. They've largely eliminated their Arctic and polar research program. We haven't heard yet about oceanography, which is how, you know, Joel and I get our funding from the National Science Foundation. So a lot is still up in the air, but it's just massively affected research, especially long-term research where people are monitoring. So I monitor specific coral reefs every year. You know, we go there every year, we measure what's there, and that's how we measure the impacts of climate change. So those kind of studies are especially vulnerable.
I have a minute left. On the one hand, proponents of these cuts say we have so many important uses for our tax dollars, including not incurring more debt, and the debt we have to pay down is enormous, and so we have to make these cuts. To others, they say, no, this research is important. It is vital in some cases. Tell us why that's the way to go. Tell us why the cuts are a mistake.
Well, it's honestly an incredibly small amount of money. So we're talking like, you know, $10 million from the entire program that Joel and I get most of our funding from. But humans depend on seafood. We depend on protein from the ocean. You know, fisheries are incredibly important. And climate change is massively impacting fisheries. You know, fish populations are growing more slowly. They're becoming more scarce. So, you know, there's a direct human component here.
And Donald Trump has said, with regard to climate change, that it is a hoax. In a 2022 campaign speech, he said that one of our most urgent tasks is to decisively defeat the climate hysteria hoax. Is he wrong?
Climate change is probably the most well-documented fact on the planet Earth.
And we'll leave it at that. Thank you very much. Dr. John Bruno, Dr. Savannah River, and Dr. Joel Fodry, all from UNC Chapel Hill.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.